we'll bring you the April 24th, 2009 edition of The Rain Report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. This is The Rain Report, this week mourning the passing of an old friend, Dale Shimp, W9LOV. Some thoughts about Dale's legacy will follow this week's program. I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN. SDR, software-defined radios, are those so-called black boxes you find in more and more ham shacks today, enabling one ham's rig to be controlled entirely from one computer. But will SDR radios replace your traditional knobs, buttons, and switches? And how accessible are SDR units for the blind ham? For answers to such questions, Rain's Hap Holly, KC9RP, spoke with Australia SDR expert Phil Harmon, BK6APH.
What is software-defined radio, and how did it evolve, and where is it today?
Software-defined radio is about using the power of computers to do what typically would be done using analog processing. So rather than use analog filters, analog mixers, analog decoding, you use the power of digital processing.
What's the advantage of that?
The advantage of that is you can do things in the digital world that are either very difficult or impossible to do in the analog world, such as making filters that really have got brick wall responses that roll over almost infinity, and to process signals not quite as good as the human ear-brain combination, i.e. CW signals, but to process signals that are virtually at the noise or below the noise level.
Like PSK31 does.
Like PSK31 and some of the other digital modes, the moon bounce modes, where in fact you can't hear the signal, it's way below the noise level.
How did this evolve?
This current round of software-defined radio really started with an article a number of years ago by Gerald Youngblood in QEX. He's K5 SDR now, and Gerald started a company resulted from the success he had with building about 50 board sets for enthusiasts to copy his hardware and start using his software. And he's started a company called Flex Radio, which is now one of the premier companies in providing commercial software-defined radios for the ham community. So his little series of four articles in QEX has really been responsible for the revolution now and the change from analog to digital construction and design development amongst experimental hams.
What year did that article come out?
About 5 years ago.
And I must have interviewed him shortly after he wrote an article. It's been a while, but it has been at least 5 years.
Yes. So I came across that article by chance. I was visiting a ham friend in the UK, and he had an afternoon. He had to go and do some work, so he left me in his shack, and I picked up this copy of QEX and read about using basically a PC and a standard sound card to do the conversion from analog to digital and back again. And it's just something I'd been interested in for many years. And I didn't think it would be possible to do it with very simple hardware and software. And that was the change for me and subsequently many other people.
So where are we today?
Where are we today is we now have commercial radios which you can purchase, which are black boxes typically. You plug your PC in, you plug your microphone in, your antenna in, and there's a healthy market for those products. People find that those sort of radios, if you have an interest in using computers in your shack, then that sort of radio is well suited to you. Typically, there's no knobs on those radios. You use your mouse and a keyboard to operate them. So it's not for everybody. If you've been using conventional analog radios with knobs and dials and switches, then and not using computers in your ham shack for communications, then perhaps it's a bit of a change. But more and more people are finding that the advantages of using software-defined radios over analog, particularly if you're a contester and you don't use those technologies, then you're going to be slipping down the ladder, so to speak, because your competitors will be.
I probably fit into the majority of hams where I use both a radio with knobs and buttons and switches, but I also do have a Windows computer and I do all my editing for the Rain Report on and so forth. For me personally, I don't know, there's just something about, of course, being a blind person that may skew my view of this, but I really like the idea of having these knobs and buttons and switches to be able to use on my radio.
That was certainly the view of many of us when we started building and working and designing on the software-defined radios. We made the screens look and operate like an analog radio. And in fact, today you can still buy like a mouse which has a knob on it, and you can control your radio just like a normal radio. Turn the knob and you tune the frequency. What I personally found, I know a lot of my friends have as well, was that after a while you suddenly find that the user interface of being able to look at a large spectrum of the band, seeing a signal the instant it appears on the band without having to tune to it, and then be able to move your mouse on it and click on it and be the first guy in the area to pick up that signal because you saw them appear 20, 30, 40, 50 kilohertz from where you're operating, is a distinct advantage.
So it's a high-tech, what we used to call a pan adapter.
It's a high-tech pan adapter with a major difference, and that is with a pan adapter which uses conventional analog techniques, there's a limit to the bandwidth of the filter you can use, which you effectively sweep over the band. So in the early days of radio, Heathkit and many others built the pan adapters, which you could plug in or use them as a standalone. And they used super heterodyne techniques. You would sweep a filter of perhaps a few kilohertz wide across the spectrum repeatedly. And I certainly played with those in my early days of ham radio. I used long persistent CRTs so you could continually see the image. The issue with that is you want a very narrow filter so you can see very weak signals. The narrower the filter, the slower you have to sweep it across the spectrum. So it's quite possible if you had a very narrow filter, and we're talking in the digital world of 10 or 11 hertz wide, if you swept that over a 20-meter band, you'd be sitting there for half an hour as this thing swept across.
You're listening to a conversation that software-defined radio STR specialist Phil Harmon, VK6APH, had with Rain's Hap Holly, KC9RP, at the 2008 Digital Communications Conference held in Chicago. Hap will conclude his conversation with Phil in a moment. This is the Rain Report, available as a terrestrial dial-up for your cell phone users at 773-358-7845. Thanks to Uddle Systems, UDDLE.com. In fact, you can hear the last 7 reports on demand 24/7 there. That dial-up number once again, 773-358-7845. We'll be right back.
With digital processing, we can effectively have thousands of receivers 10 hertz wide in parallel, all operating in real time. So the moment that first dot appears down the bottom of the band, you can be down there and actually see it happen. We can't do that in the analog world.
Now, is this strictly digital, or would this apply to any mode?
Any mode. So after a while, you become fairly good at looking at the spectrum on the screen, and you can see that's an RTTY signal, you can see that's a sideband signal, and you also see that guy's got a problem. His transmitter's not working too well, he's splattering, he's got poor sideband suppression, poor carrier expression. And I've certainly found over the years, I've been doing this for a couple of years now, I can click on a sideband signal and I can pretty well have tuned it in fairly close to one click, just a little bit of fine-tuning. I find personally that going back to an old-fashioned radio, if I could call it, with knobs, I really miss the band scope. And I use the band scope enormously to get myself around the band, to find if there's where the strong signals are, where the pile-ups are, where people are calling in pile-ups. So probably, for me, the most significant development has been the pan adapter with very, very fine frequency resolution and very, very good sensitivity.
I would imagine the challenge of using such a software pan adapter with a pile-up is that you would see so many stations up and down and have to try to figure out, well, where's the actual DX station itself?
Typically, the DX station will be on the standard calling frequency. So let's say it's 20 meters, it'll be on 41.95. So you can park perhaps the center of your band scope on 41.95, and you'll see the DX station operating without necessarily having to tune to that station, okay? So every time he calls somebody, you'll see him operate. You'll then see further up the band a whole mass of people spread over perhaps 15, 20 kilohertz, and they're all calling at once. You'll then see the DX station make a transmission, and one of those guys will come back. So you know exactly where to tail end.
So you can actually, in one screen width, see anywhere from a couple of kilohertz to how wide?
Well, typically 192 kilohertz.
Why 192?
192 is a standard sampling frequency for a sound card. So typically, sound cards sample at 48 kilohertz, 96 kilohertz, or 192 kilohertz. So by using sound card technology, which up until now has been predominant in software-defined radios, you use the sound card in your radio or a sound card chip in the hardware to do your analog to digital conversion. So that by using these chips, you get 48 kilohertz bandwidth if you sample your audio signal at 48K, or 96 or 192. So 192 kilohertz up to now has been the maximum bandwidth you can display on the screen simultaneously.
You foresee that doubling in time?
No. I see that going up to seeing the entire 30 meg spectrum in real time. There's digital receivers at the moment where you can be working on 160 meters and watching 6 meters at the same time, all on the same screen.
That's almost information overload.
It certainly is.
Wow. Is this technology being embraced as much in Australia and the South Pacific as it is stateside?
Certainly in Australia it is, yes. The interest in software-defined radios, the membership of the various software-defined radio groups, the email reflectors, etc., is pretty high, based on the percentage of population we have compared to the rest of the world.
What concerns me as a blind person is how accessible, especially as we know more and more with a black box and a computer, and less with your traditional knobs, switches, and buttons, that how well the blind ham will be able to access that technology.
Well, I'd imagine that the interface you would use would be by a keyboard. So you would configure the keyboard to have standard control functions in order to enable you to change filters, change bands, tune in frequency steps, etc., etc. So I wouldn't think, if you're a blind ham and you're used to using a keyboard to operate a computer, I'd think the transition would be relatively simple.
Except that I'm not so sure how well that would apply to panning, to looking up and down the dial.
Right.
Well, so I suppose that would be represented as certain graphics. The problem is that talking screen readers do not do well with graphics.
Well, typically, you can either use a conventional knob, USB knob, plug into your PC, but I found now that using my mouse and using the scroll wheel in my mouse to tune the radio is my preferred method of tuning. So what I'll do is look on the band scope, I'll find the station of interest, I'll click as close as I can to the station, and then use my mouse scroll wheel to fine-tune. Now, the other thing you could do is you could set... the other process you use is to drag your display. So if you imagine the frequency was printed on a film strip, and you could grab a portion of the film strip and just move it back and forwards. As you move the film strip, you tune the receiver. So what you could do is you could set one end of the film strip to be one end of the band, the other end of the film strip to the other, and you'd use your mouse to slide backwards and forwards, so you would never go in or out of the band. So you'd never go outside the band limits.
Interesting. If someone would like more information about SDR radios, where do you suggest they go?
Well, the Flex Radio home site, www.flex-radio.com, is a good source of information for their products. www.flex-radio.com. If you're interested in home construction and home brewing, then the High Performance Software Defined Radio website, HPSDR, is www.hpsdr.org. www.hpsdr.org.
And if someone would like to communicate with you directly,
they can contact me at Phil, P-H-I-L, at pharman, P-H-A-R-M-A-N, .org. Phil, P-H-I-L, at pharman, P-H-A-R-M-A-N, .org.
That was Phil Harmon, VK6APH, an Australian ham whose expertise in SDR, software-defined radios, earned him the top forum slot at the 2008 Digital Communications Conference held in Chicago. We have some sad news to report, especially for you Chicago area listeners that used to listen to the Bear Information Service in the 80s. RAIN's founder and producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, and many others are mourning the recent passing of Dale Shemp, W9LOV. Dale was a longtime engineer with WLS Radio in Chicago. In the early 80s and 90s, Dale served as trustee for the Bear Broadcast Employees Amateur Repeater in Schaumburg, Illinois, on 145.15 MHz. The Bear Information Service, later dubbed BIS, was Dale's brainchild in 1984. With Dale's nurturing and support, the BIS served as the training ground for Hap Holly's early production work. Eventually, Hap was named 2002 Dayton's Hamvention Ham of the Year, largely due to his quality and unbiased audio programming that originated on Dale's repeater, thanks to Dale's innovative approach to informational nets. Today you know Hap's work as these RAIN reports. Dale Shimp's connection to WLS Radio and the ABC network, where he served as radio engineer for decades, resulted in the Bear being the first and only Chicago repeater to have aired multiple top-of-the-hour celebrity IDs recorded on broadcast carts by the likes of the late Paul Harvey, former First Lady Barbara Bush, former Illinois Governor Jim Thompson, and others. Later, with Dale's encouragement, Hap Holly produced a series of seasonal ID packages that featured members of the Bear organization in the late 80s and early 90s, something not heard since in Chicago. With Dale's assistance, the Bear Information Service aired on a handful of VHF and UHF Chicago area repeaters during its reign as the Midwest's premier info service from 1984 to 1989. At its peak, this weekly info service garnered 90 check-ins a week, topping out one week with 120 check-ins. Though the Bear became known nationwide in broadcast circles, Dale's dream of his repeater service as a mecca for Chicago area hams in the broadcast industry never came to fruition. The enormous egos too often found in the broadcast field led to the demise of Dale's dream in the 90s and eventual dissolving of the organization itself, along with the 145.15 MHz Bear repeater. Dale's unfulfilled dream was a source of sadness for him during his retirement years as a Spring Hill, Florida resident. Dale's legacy will now live on through these rain reports. Dale Shimp, W9LOV, now a silent key. Dale may be gone, but he will never be forgotten. The Rain Report is copyright 1990 through 2009 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Dwayne Whittingham, N9SSN, bidding you a very 73 from all of us at Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com. See you at the Dayton Hamvention next month.